Welcome here to the European Parliament's office in Europe House. My name is Sarah Hayman. I'm from London School of Economics, and I'm very happy to welcome you and moderate this event tonight. I have to make a very first apology, which I've just been told that it's going to be a bit hot in here because there's no air conditioning, it's not working. So Europe House apologizes in advance. But we are going to have a great and lively debate, I'm sure. And the reason why I know that that's going to happen is because there's a very interesting study that will be presented to you today on the press coverage of the EU referendum. And in reaction to the findings from that study, we have a great panel. I won't present the panel straight away. First, I'd like to give the word to Richard Bagnov, who has facilitated or contributed also to this study. So, Richard, to you.
Thank you very much. Hello, good evening, and welcome, everybody. Thank you for joining us for the launch of our report, British Press Coverage of the Referendum. So I'm Richard Bagnall, I'm the CEO of Prime Research in the UK, but Prime Research is a global media intelligence business, which means that we specialise in analysing earned media, both in the mainstream press, but also in social and digital channels as well. As an organisation, we're founded in the 1980s, and we have our roots in academic research, and today the UK office is based in Oxford, and that means that we're delighted to be able to support academia still with our collaboration with the university's Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. So rigorous, credible and meaningful analysis are at the heart of our business. Given the importance, the historical importance of the EU referendum, we are absolutely thrilled to be asked to collaborate on this project. What Prime did was we provided a team of media analysts and data insights experts who monitored, coded and evaluated all of the content. Then we worked with the Reuters Institute to visualise this data, identify the insights and produce the report that you'll be receiving tonight. A lot of hard work has gone into it, and a big thank you is owed to everybody, our partners at the Oxford University Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, in particular to David Levy, who's director of the Institute and was the lead author on the report, but also to Billa Aslan, who's David's research assistant, and Prime's lead, Diego Baronzo, who took a lead from our side. Thank you, finally, to the European Parliament Office for hosting tonight's event, to all of our speakers and panellists. We're very grateful for you being here. And, of course, to each and every one of you in the room. Sorry, again, the aircon's not working. And those of you perhaps better off following along on the live web stream as well. I'm looking forward to what I'm sure is going to be a fascinating evening's conversation. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Richard. So I'm going to give the word to David Levy to take us through the research and the findings in about 15 minutes. But in order for us to go straight into a debate afterwards, I would like at this point to introduce each of the panelists. And the reason is also because I've seen the results from the research. I know it raises a lot of interesting issues. And the panel we have today are experts from very different, who have had very different experiences during the campaign. And I think we're very fortunate to have such a great panel here together. So first of all, after having heard the results from David, we will turn to Matthew. Matthew Elliott is the chief executive of the Vote Leave campaign and has also held a number of interesting positions in other campaigns. He was the founder of Big Brother Watch, the Taxpayers Alliance, and was the campaign director for the very successful referendum campaign No to AV during the 2011 alternative vote referendum. We'll also hear from Lucy Thomas, who's the deputy director from Britain Stronger in Europe. And Lucy has also held a number of positions in other places, such as the Department of Health and the Cabinet Office, and senior positions as deputy director and for a time also as interim director in Business for New Europe. And from 2007 to 2012, I remember Lucy from Brussels as a producer at the BBC. We will also hear from Richard Corbett, who is MEP and deputy leader of Labour members of the European Parliament and has been in the European Parliament for many years, since 96. I should say Richard has also written a number of great books and textbooks. I use them in my teaching at LSE. Is Vice President of the UK European Movement and Chair in the European Parliament of the Labour Movement for Europe. We will also hear from Jonathan Isaby, who is the editor of Brexit Central and a former journalist both at the BBC, the Daily Telegraph and Conservative Home. But I'd like to first hear from David all the interesting results, and then we'll get the take from the panel afterwards. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sarah. And thanks, everybody, for coming along tonight. And as you can see here, this is a joint effort between three of us, and we're really grateful to the support we had from Prime Research in helping making this possible, and especially to your colleague, Richard Diego Baronzo, who's sitting here, and to Bilal Aslan, who's there. I'm going to talk through the findings of this quite fast. When you leave, you'll be given a copy of the full report. So if you feel you've missed something because I've gone too fast, don't worry, you will get a copy later on. I want to give a quick overview of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk a little bit about the methods we used and the context in which the campaign took place. We basically had two research questions that we set out to answer. How did the British press cover the EU referendum story? And what were the main stories and issues presented on each side of the argument? I'll then go through some findings and then speculate on some implications. So firstly, what did we do? We basically looked at nine newspapers over the four-month period of the referendum campaign from February the 20th to June the 21st. We only chose Tuesdays and Saturdays. Press analysis of newspapers is pretty labour-intensive. We got a lot of support from Prime, but we had to sort of bound the thing in some way. 2 days a week we looked at, that's 36 days over the 4 months of the campaign. The main national newspapers are the ones we looked at. We brought together 3,400 articles in total, but most of the analysis we're presenting today is about the 2,378 articles focused on the referendum. We measured things like the volume of coverage, the degree of partisanship in the way things were covered, the main issues covered, the spokespeople, and the tone of coverage. And I'll come back to some of those briefly afterwards. Three caveats about the findings here. Firstly, we did not, you see, Tuesdays and Saturdays, so we haven't included Sunday newspapers. In hindsight, that's a shame, because there was a story about the Mail on Sunday having a different position from the Daily Mail, and a story about the Sunday Times having a different position from the Times, but there we are. Secondly, we made no attempt to assess the quality or accuracy of stories. With 3,500 articles, it was quite enough to do the things we set out to do rather than anything else. So we make no claims about quality or accuracy of any of the coverage. And we only look at the press. We're not looking at broadcast at all or online. And I'll make some comments about that towards the end. So the first thing I want to do, having sort of told you about what we did, is really just to say, well, when did Europe become a salient issue? When did it start to matter? And here we pulled together two questions that Ipsos Mori have asked people every month. We've given you the figures here since 2000. The questions are, what's the most important issue to you, or the second most important issue to you at the moment in terms of the world of politics? And we tracked here the results on immigration and Europe. And what you see here since the year 2000, immigration has always scored quite high in people's concerns, but Europe has not always been so high. And actually, since about 2005 until recently, Europe was always below 10% in terms of the number of people who said it was their first or second most important issue at the moment. And in 2010, when the coalition government was elected, just 1% of people named Europe as the most important or the second most important issue to them at the moment. That all changed in the period since 2014. You remember the European elections of 2014. And UKIP did very well in those elections. They won those elections, and they also, from my perspective, they brought together the issues of Europe and immigration, and then Europe, the figures for Europe moved up a long way. And you can see the interest in Europe moved up a very, very long way on the in the run-up to the referendum. And it's not here, but it's in the report. And the increase of interest in Europe corresponded with a decline in support for David Cameron as a leader, which plummets straight after the 2015 election. So we're going to look at the findings. I'm going to go through the issue of partisanship, the spokespeople quoted, the topics covered, and tone. So firstly, partisanship. This is looking at the 2,378 articles focused on the referendum across the 4 months. And we can see here 27% of them were coded as pro-Remain of the articles that have been studied, and 41% as pro-Leave, the rest with no position or mixed or undecided. If we look at how this breaks down by newspaper, the same colour coding applies. If you're sitting at the back, yellow means pro-Leave, blue means pro-Remain. And what we see is a very different position according to different newspapers and how they break down. 6 out of 9 newspapers had a majority of pro-Leave stories, the yellow bar here. 3, a majority of, pro-Remain dominated. Amongst the pro-Leave newspapers, or the newspapers that have most pro-Leave articles, they're led by the Daily Express, 74% pro-Leave, followed by the Mail, 58%, the Telegraph, 47%. The 3 newspapers with the most pro-Remain coverage at the top here, The Mirror, The Guardian, and the FT. The Times is somewhere in the middle there. It's quite an interesting story about The Times. 35% of pro-Leave articles, 22% pro-Remain. I'll come back to The Times a bit later. So that's the kind of crude figure about how the coverage broke down between Leave and Remain. We then, with Prime's help, we then tried to weight the positions of each newspaper by reach, largely done by readership, and also the volume of articles. And what you can see here, the size of the bubbles is the number of articles in each newspaper. Up here is the average reach of an article of the article in each newspaper, and left to right at the bottom is Leave or Remain. So what we see here is we see that the Daily Mail and the Sun are the most pro-Leave newspapers that have the greatest reach and the pro-Leave camp. The other newspapers that were pretty pro-Leave, the Express, very, very pro-Leave here, but not a lot of impact. And on the right-hand side, I suppose, the Mirror was the most popular pro-Remain newspaper, but relatively rather less impact. And then the FT and The Guardian, relatively low in terms of impact. When you factor in this reach metric alongside the overall balance of coverage, which I told you before was 41% pro-Leave to 41% pro-Leave to 27% pro-Remain, the figures change and the pro-Leave coverage increases to 48% after taking account of reach, and the Remain coverage goes down to 22%. So I want to move on to talk about spokespeople who were cited. 55% of all the coverage cited a spokesperson of some kind, using a quote from different categories of spokespeople. But they came from quite a limited range of sources. So just looking here, you can see that UK politicians, 34%, were the largest single category of people cited, followed by campaign representatives, members of the public, analysts, economists, and experts. And you'll see academics here are just 2%. Now, you may think I'm party pre and think it's a bit of a shame that there are only 2% of academics cited, but be that as it may, what was interesting is that amongst that 2%, one academic, Patrick Minford, accounted for 1/5 of all the academics quoted in our sample. It's a small sample, 2%, but it's quite striking all the same. I'm going to go into these figures in a little bit more detail whilst being brief. So firstly, the politicians. The 34% of quotes of politicians, who were they? 64% were Conservative, 17% Labour. I won't talk about the other parties at the moment in the interests of time. even amongst the Conservatives who were quoted and the Labour people who were quoted, there's quite a limited range of people. The top people quoted throughout the campaign, Cameron, Johnson, Osborne and Gove, the top four people quoted. Jeremy Corbyn was the eighth most quoted person in the campaign, but only in about 3% of articles. Only one other Labour person was in the top 20 people quoted overall. That was Gordon Brown. Theresa May was in 11th place, mentioned in just 1% of all articles. That's the politicians. Moving on to the campaign representatives, one can see that there was a strong predominance of campaign representatives. This is just in 14% of articles. 74% who were quoted were from Pro-Leave, 26% Remain. I move on to the topics that were covered. What was the coverage looking at? For this, Prime Research worked at the message level rather than the article level, since each article can include multiple messages. Happy to discuss that with you afterwards, but I'm not going to drill into it now. What you need to know is there are about 20,000 messages across the 2,378 EU referendum-focused articles. Of those 20,000 messages, just about half of them dealt with arguments and issues. The other half either dealt with discussion about the campaign, discussion about personalities and public figures taking sides, or general sort of referendum Brexit stuff. If we look at the arguments or the issues that were discussed, and this is the kind of bottom thing here, we see the single biggest issue discussed was the economy and business, followed by sovereignty, migration and mobility, regulation, and so on. But these things break down very differently, these issues, between different newspapers. And so, unsurprisingly, the FT has the largest percentage of stories that talk about the economy. That's to be expected. But then we see some interesting differences. So you've got kind of the broadsheets, if you like, generally are quite focused on the economy at the top here. The Sun, interestingly, has quite a lot of coverage about the economy. But the bottom newspapers here, the Mail, the Star and the Express, are quite interesting in the sense that they give a lot more attention to the issue of sovereignty, the light blue here, migration, the pinkish colour there, and so on. So the issues pan out an overall way, but then they break down very differently as they're discussed by newspaper. I'm just going to move on to talk about tone. And this is basically what was the tone of the coverage. And this is not, this is basically the kind of adjectives used to describe what was going on by the journalists. Red is negative, 46%. This light kind of grey is factual, or no particular line. And the green, 12% positive. So the story basically is that this was a very negative campaign. Negative messages heavily outweighed any positive messages. But if one breaks that down a little bit between two different factors, one is the time period people were talking about, the top line, the present as against the future, and the other one is the articles that were pro-leave versus the articles that were pro-remain. And what we can see is, if you look at the top line here, pro-leave talking about the present. Well, it's not surprising that pro-leave were quite negative about the present. They wanted to change the status quo. It's logical. What's more surprising to me, as you're talking about the present, we have pro-remain, wanted to defend the status quo. The number of negative messages in pro-remain articles about the present outweigh the number of positive ones. 36% negative, 27% positive. Talking about the future, we see pro-leave looking about the future, UK Independence Day, retake control of our country. Quite a lot of positive messages here, 34% positive messages. Still only less than the negative ones, but still more. And pro-remain, very negative messages in the press coverage about the future. And so, in this sense, I suppose the accusations or the talk about Project Fear seems to have rung true, at least in the press coverage that we've analysed. Now, the last thing I want to do before wrapping up is just to look at, remind you again about the press coverage, which is the left-hand side. leave versus remain, leave the position of newspapers. Once again, remain is in blue, leave is in the yellow. And then on the right-hand side, the exit poll by YouGov at how readers of each of these newspapers voted. What we see is we see that, broadly speaking, the coverage of the newspapers is not a million miles apart from the way the people who read those newspapers voted. They tend to exaggerate a bit, they tend to overshoot, but they're not massively out of line. Two exceptions. The Daily Mirror, very strong pro-Remain coverage, blue versus yellow. But when it came to the vote, Mirror readers were much more likely to vote Leave than the newspaper coverage might have suggested. The other one that's interesting is the Times. Slight skewing in Times coverage towards pro-Leave. I think I said before it was about 37% to 22%, but I'm saying that from memory. But what's interesting is that Times readers heavily favoured Remain rather than Leave. And it's particularly interesting in the report itself. We look at the last week of the campaign in some detail, I'm not talking about it now, but even after the Times had announced that it was a pro, wanted to favoured a Remain vote, coverage in the Times in that last week was generally pro-Leave. Interesting. So let me recap. So firstly, the coverage varies by title, as you've seen, but overall it's very pro-Leave. 41% to 27%, and if you factor in the reach, it increases 48% to 22% pro-Leave. It's very much a blue-on-blue campaign in terms of people quoted, 64% Conservatives versus 17% Labour. And Leave campaigners are cited far more than Remain, 74% to 26%, I think. In terms of issues, personalities or the discussion about the contest seem to get more attention than any single issue. And the ways in which newspapers discuss the issues when they do discuss them is very polarised between newspapers. Remain focusing more on the economy, Leave newspapers more focused on migration, sovereignty and security. The tone is largely negative, but more so for Remain. and the paper's position's broadly in line with their readers, but not entirely. And there's two exceptions there. So why does all this matter? I said at the beginning, we've only looked at the press, we haven't looked at broadcasting and online. So what one view would be to say, who cares about newspapers anyway? Nobody's reading them. True, readership of newspapers is declining, but actually we saw newspapers putting on some readership during the referendum. I think there was a 90,000 a day increase in June. I suppose the more important point is that I think press coverage probably still matters in terms of agenda setting, both in terms of the political debate, but I think arguably it may also matter in terms of the wider media. The referendum is a rather unusual moment compared to all the broadcasters here in the UK are obliged to abide by due impartiality rules. In an election, that's relatively easy. You refer back to each party, you see how many complaints you get, and you try and sort of work out what you should do. Every broadcaster will vary, but broadly that's sort of one way of doing it. I suppose when you have an issue like Europe that cuts across both political parties and completely divides them, it's really hard as a broadcaster to know where you orientate yourself. And I suppose this is a hypothesis, which we haven't tested. We've only looked at the press coverage. But the hypothesis is, does press coverage matter more in setting the broadcast news channel's agenda in an issue like this, which is cutting across traditional political party lines? Finally, what about the referendum coverage and the voters? I'm not going to answer the question which political scientists have failed to answer over many years about whether press coverage affects the way people vote. We've just looked at one thing here. We can't draw any conclusions on that. What we can say, I think, is that the very partisan and polarised nature of the press coverage was probably better at reinforcing the views of decided voters than in informing the undecided voters. And there's been two studies recently, one we cite in the report of the British Election Study and the other from the Electoral Reform Society produced more recently after we went to print, suggesting there was a real thirst for information. I think one of those talks about people hungry for information and not really getting it. So I suppose what I'm arguing is really the coverage is very interesting. It's not surprising. We have a highly partisan press here. But this interesting question arises from this about how well the press did at informing the undecided voters. So I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much for your patience and hand over to Sarah to run the panel discussion. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, David, and a lot of food for thought, a lot of very interesting points, which I now turn to the panel to have us to take through some of them. And I will start off with Matthew, and I'd like to focus on this thing about the citations and the quotes from coming mainly from the Leave side. 74% of representatives quoted were from the Leave side, compared to only 24 from the pro-Remain side. Do you recognise that figure in terms of your experience, and what do you make of that? Do you think that figure accurately captures also your experience during the campaign?
I don't really recognise that figure, actually. And I think if you look back to the slide, I think it was slide 10, where I think that of the spokespersons cited, 14% were campaign representatives. I think if you look at the other people cited, like government ministers and supranational organisations and celebrities and what have you, you'd often, during the course of the campaign, have a situation where you'd have a spokesperson for the IMF or the Chancellor speaking or another expert making an intervention. And the Leave side will respond with a campaign representative. So overall, in terms of balance, you might say it was balanced, but the Remain person wasn't necessarily Lucy, or a campaign spokesperson, but somebody actually from the overall establishment, if you like. So I think it was balanced overall, but okay, amongst the campaign representatives, it's probably a slight bias, but it was only 14% of the overall spokespeople.
But how do you think that it changed during the campaign in the months and then days leading up to the campaign?
I think there were several phases in the campaign, really. If you look at the phase from when David Cameron came back with his deal in February up until the Purdah period, certainly the feeling from sort of Vote Leave's point of view was that really the Remain campaign were really making the running. And that drip feed of press statements, stacking up the economic project fair, basically meant they were almost always on the back foot. We find it very difficult to actually cut through ourselves. So often you have a situation where the latest press release from the Remain campaign would get the top billing on the news agenda, and then we would, reply with a spokesperson from the campaign, but we were still very much on the back foot. When you then got through to the short campaign, the Purdah period, then it was more balanced. We got the feeling that broadcasters were giving a much more equal ride to the Leave campaign. And often if we had a good story, or if Boris was doing something interesting, or we had a good piece of research out, that could equally get top billing on the 10 o'clock news, just like the Remain campaigns did earlier on in the campaign.
Okay. So another point that has been made now is that it was mainly after the 2009 European elections and the success of UKIP with putting migration up on as one of the main topics, and that continued into the referendum period. Do you think that that rings true, that UKIP has been successful in placing that as the top topic that then made people also react based on their migration fears, and that's what led to the success of the Leave campaign?
I think there was always a question for Eurosceptics overall, why does the EU matter to me? And I think what migration did was a very real way in which the EU was affecting people's lives. So UKIP managed to create the link between an issue which was of big concern to people, migration, with the EU and membership of the European Union. I think there's one other issue worth pointing out at this stage, though, which I think was equally important in the past 10, 15 years, and that was the Eurozone crisis. So I think that up until that point, there was always a general feeling that being a member of the EU is generally good for our economy, and the EU is generally overall an economic force for good. But after the Eurozone crisis, two things happened. First of all, it was seen to be a declining economic continent. Mm. But secondly, some of the people who were such fervent supporters of Britain joining the Euro, I think, lost credibility in quite a big way at that point, because in debates in the early 2000s, some of the lines we heard during the referendum about what would happen if we left the EU in terms of greater unemployment or the decline of the City of London or the decline of foreign investment into the UK. Some of those lines were also used in the case against Britain, sorry, for Britain joining the Euro. And of course, in the eyes of many voters, it was the right thing that we didn't join the Euro. And therefore, those experts had been proved wrong in their analysis, so they carried less credibility when it came to the EU referendum debate.
Right, but interestingly, I mean, it's been pointed out many times that, of course, the UK is not a Eurozone member, and that was not a part of the question, but that the economy, people in surveys have expressed in that they did feel that EU membership was economically beneficial. Despite what is going on in the continent, there is still economic growth in Europe, sure, and that jobs, etc., depended on it. But we also heard here that it was reflected in the press that there were the three main topics, the economy, migration, and sovereignty, but it seemed that it was this sovereignty and migration, sure, versus the economy. And the two first ones ended up trumping the economic aspects.
They did. Yeah. Well, I talked about the Eurozone crisis. It's worth touching on the financial crisis as well. Because one of the key points about the financial crisis was that, people's became very distrustful of bankers and very distrustful of big business. So when you started having letters from investment banks or big multinationals saying how we must stay in the EU, how it's for Britain's economic benefit, people didn't trust these spokespeople as much as they would have 10 years prior to that.
Okay. Lucy, let me turn to you. So the Pro-Remain campaign did less well with getting its message through, is what we've just heard. What do you think explains that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's interesting that it is only print media. And I think in terms of reaching voters, that is a bit of a shame, because I think what, in particular, those undecided voters in the middle, who we split into two categories, known as heart versus head, whose heart said we just need to get out of the EU, costs too much, too bureaucratic, but the head thinks it might be a bit too risky. There was also the sort of disaffected middle who were unlikely to vote, were slightly more pro-Remain, but didn't really get how any politics affected them at all, you know, whether it's our government or Brussels. And they were predominantly hanging out on Facebook, other social media. They were looking at BBC Online and the Daily Mail Online if they looked at any news. So I think the mail is very, very important here. But I also think that means that what they are seeing on their Facebook feed and other things is what is shareable content. And what Matthew's side of the argument, and also the Leave.eu campaign and UKIP, who, you know, obviously ran a different campaign with different messages. It was that combination of the sort of vote leave agenda more in the mainstream, but also those very shareable and, yes, sometimes shocking images and messages from Leave.eu, who interestingly had somebody who is now working for Donald Trump advising their campaign and social media and almost saying, you know, inviting that controversy and saying, right, we're going to stick that up there. You guys complain if you want to, but it is reaching people and getting the message out. So in terms of volume and share of media, I think Matthew's campaign did an excellent job in turning this into a blue-on-blue war. I think the Conservatives, in deciding to be neutral as a party and suspending collective responsibility, that meant it was a free-for-all. Effectively, you had cabinet ministers criticising their own government, saying, this Treasury document's a load of old nonsense, even though they're still a cabinet minister in that government, which was totally unprecedented, and meant that the waters were totally muddied, and so you had credible politicians of the governing party on both sides of the argument. And that phasing also that Matthew talked about, I think the renegotiation, with hindsight, left a huge amount of airtime for Matthew's campaign to basically say, it's not going to be enough, or the renegotiation is going a bit badly. Hey, look, it isn't enough when it comes out the other end. So all of this time is about the negatives of the EU, why our deal currently isn't good enough and why the future deal isn't going to be good enough. Meanwhile, the government is still impasse. You know, it hasn't officially made up its mind. So it meant that the phasing was not, for all of that time, a question of whether we should be in or out, but is this government credible? Is David Cameron, who started off as the most credible of the politicians, and by the end of that renegotiation, as we saw, his credibility shot?
But David's results have just suggested that it was, in fact, the Leave campaign that was more positive in its messages, conveying a more positive future, and that the Remain campaign failed on that. So you don't recognise that?
Well, I think that there has to be a huge distinction drawn between the messages that we were putting out there and what gets covered, particularly in print.
Okay.
So this is, you know, one part of what is covered. The title of our campaign was Britain Stronger in Europe. Our main tagline was that we were stronger, safer and better off in Europe than we would be out on our own. And if you look at any number of speeches, press releases, a huge amount of it was about here are all the positives of remaining in, or, you know, we'd produce a report talking about all the future jobs that would be created if we remain part of the single market, if we end up benefiting from TTIP and other trade deals. But they don't get covered. And particularly at the beginning of the campaign, trying to get any kind of cut through, you know, as a campaign just coming out of the blocks, talking about the positives. That's not an interesting story, particularly for the press. And when you see, you know, how skewed they were on one side, we got to a point where the Daily Mail literally said to us, do not bother sending us press releases, don't bother sending us rebuttal, because we're not going to run it.
So you think that it was because the stories were not interesting, or that they had already taken a position?
No, I think it's a more interesting story to report the negatives. It's much more pithy and hard-hitting to say, Remain campaign says this many jobs are going to be lost. And so you end up in a little bit of a sort of race with them, if you like. And also, if you look at, you know, a speech that any of our spokespeople made, politicians or anybody else, they go and visit a factory. They spend a long time talking about all the positives. And yes, they're asked whether, you know, future investment might be affected or something. That is the bit that's interesting to people. So again, it's about what gets covered rather than what necessarily we're saying. And lastly, I'd bring up our referendum campaign broadcasts, which are, you know, that's the basically the way that you can speak directly to voters on broadcast. You're each given equal slots on all of the main broadcast media. And all of ours were positive. We started with a little baby called Sam and talking about all of his future opportunities and what being in the EU would mean for him. There was another one with a series of experts from Stephen Hawking to Alan Sugar to lots of well-known people. Meanwhile, Matthew's broadcast had a load of big red arrows coming from Albania, Macedonia and God knows where, who were all going to descend on our NHS, which, by the way, is going to get £350 million a week back. I think that's a little bit of context about what the campaigns themselves were doing.
Okay, thank you. Jonathan, I'll turn to you. And so given your past experience, both with print and broadcast media, so you've been at the BBC and at the Telegraph, what do you think about the findings we see here and then the general coverage also from the broadcasters?
Well, I was slightly surprised to find that the Express was only 74% pro-Leave in its coverage. that suggests that a quarter of its coverage was either neutral or in favour of Remain. And, of course, at the end of the day, what was it, about 20% of Express readers did actually vote Remain. So, at the end of the day, a newspaper does not necessarily dictate how people are going to vote. And indeed, I think as the you made the point at the end about, you know, the Mirror had a sizeable vote for Leave, despite the fact that its editorial slant was very much on the other side. So I think you know, it confirms my view that overall, newspapers tend to reflect their readers' views rather than trying to change their readers' minds in order to take a different position. Newspapers have a product to sell. You know, you want to make your product attractive and something that your potential customers are going to be conducive to wanting to read. Hence you reflect their positions. And you know, at the end of the day, I've always thought, certainly over the last decade or so, that the instinctive position of the British people was actually relatively Eurosceptic. So I'm not entirely surprised that 6 out of the 9 papers reflect that kind of position.
Okay. And what about the point that was made by David about the newspapers setting the agenda for the media in general? Do you think that rings true for the campaign here?
I mean, clearly, newspapers are always going to have a role to play in setting the agenda, although which newspaper sets the agenda? I would say, I mean, I can't give you numbers or, you know, qualitative evidence to back it up, but I think, you know, I would suggest that anecdotally, The Guardian has a massively disproportionate influence over the agenda of broadcasters, particularly the BBC, as compared with the number of readers it has, and you know, its slant in terms of how it represents things overall. Thinking more generally about broadcasters, I think most central broadcasting is here in London. London had a big Remain vote. I think, I can't have figures to show how staff at different broadcasting organisations voted, but my instinct would be that there was quite a slant towards a Remain vote, representing the kind of liberal metropolitan elite, you know, that are people working in broadcast journalism. Mm. Inevitably that feeds into the way in which they do their work.
Okay. So turning to a slightly different point that was made during the presentation regarding the citation of some of the politicians, notably now the political leaders, Theresa May was cited
as away from the scene of the crime.
Yeah. What do you make of that, also for the current situation?
Well, I think it was clearly a relatively canny judgment on her part, in that had she been a leading spokesman for Remain, I think there'd be a lot of Conservative politicians who would have been less comfortable about her taking over the leadership of their party. That was then, this is now, and she's been very clear in terms of accepting the referendum result and working with it. In terms of the way politicians behaved, I think, I was astounded by what Tim Farron said in his conference speech this afternoon, in which he suggested that if only George Osborne hadn't threatened the emergency budget, the British people would have voted Remain. I mean, I simply don't buy it. I think the Project Fear emergency budget stuff was utterly preposterous, and I think, you know, the way in which George Osborne and the government spent huge amounts of taxpayers' money trying to scare people into voting a particular way was wrong. But you know, there's a far broader narrative here. There are far, you know, the absence of Labour figures representing themselves in the campaign, and you know, how Jeremy Corbyn behaved, I think, was an interesting factor in terms of the political balance. I go back to the fact that Theresa May, say, cannily stayed away from the limelight, and in a sense that gives her a relatively clean bill of health in terms of now carrying out the instructions that the British people gave her in such a great number. Because lest we forget, more people did vote to leave the European Union than have ever voted for anything or anyone in the history of British elections.
Hmm. Okay. What do you think, if you also reflecting what has already been said, what is the main reason you take from all of this for the success of the Leave campaign?
I think the positive message, actually, you know, taking back control, you know, regaining sovereignty. And again, I think it's worth noting in David's presentation that in every single paper, there was more coverage of the sovereignty issue than the migration issue, despite the fact that some people suggesting that this was that the Leave campaign or certain elements of the Leave campaign were scaremongering about immigration. No, sovereignty was a bigger issue, and say every newspaper reflected that in terms of its coverage. And the British people had enough of not having that control. There was a great piece that we published on Brexit Central this morning, which I hope you're all reading, brexitcentral.com, sign up for our daily email. Marc Francois, who was Shadow Europe Minister between 2007 and 2010, wrote a piece saying that actually the way that the then Labour government handled, or rather mishandled, the Lisbon Treaty, what was the European Constitution, became the Lisbon Treaty, you know, wouldn't have a referendum, pushed it through, the way in which the British public were treated at that juncture actually seriously sowed seeds of resentment and concern that, say, this political elite, this European elite, were pushing through all this stuff without recourse to the people for their consent. And, frankly, enough was enough.
Okay, thank you. Richard, you were out on the doorsteps and very active during the whole campaign and still are very active in the debate, of course. What is your take on the splits we've heard here between migration, sovereignty and immigration? Do you recognise that those three topics were divided in that way?
Yes, I think migration was the one that dominated. I hear what you say that there was also sovereignty, but I have here the front page headlines of the Daily Mail, one after another, day after day, day after day. Britain's wide open borders. Migrants could push UK out. EU deal risks wave of migrants. Migrants, how many more can we take? Calais besieged. 1.6 million migrants coming from wherever. The swarm is on, day after day after day. It was clearly a very big issue. The Remain camp, I think, tended to shy away from it. Sort of said either, well, yeah, it's a problem, but the economy is much more important. Or tried to persuade people of the benefits of migration, which you weren't going to do in a short campaign to people who already have very high concerns. And they failed to point out, and that's an issue linked to Theresa May's quietness during the campaign. I think it's not just the opportunism that you mentioned. It's related to the fact that she was Home Secretary. She's responsible for immigration. And remember, the Conservatives had pledged to reduce it to tens of thousands per year, which obviously they completely failed to do, even for that part of migration, which is the bulk of migration to Britain, from outside the EU, which is entirely under British rules and nothing to do with the European Union. So failing to do that, it was very convenient, wasn't it, to blame it all on EU free movement, even though that's a reciprocal right, of course, with millions of Brits in other EU countries as well as others here, and those here paying more in tax than they take in benefits. The Leave campaign never managed to do that, partly because the Conservative part of the campaign didn't want to highlight an issue which reflected badly on the Conservative government. And so, to a large degree, we lost it on migration. Not only, but to a very large degree.
Okay. And so, maybe this is very close to home, but the figures on the citations of the later Labour leadership coming such so low in the citation percentages, what should we make of that? And is that one of the reasons why we saw such a failure also of the other arguments coming up strongly?
Yeah, I think the leading pro-European campaigners in terms of parties all had difficulties. David Cameron in the middle of his second term as Prime Minister, all Prime Ministers soon after they're re-elected have a dip in popularity. George Osborne after another shambolic budget. And yes, Jeremy Corbyn, let's be honest. I mean, OK, it's very difficult for Jeremy to get media coverage. He is only leader of the opposition. And it did happen to coincide with a period that he'd booked to have a holiday, which was very unfair. But, OK, let's be honest. One of the reasons there is a big row in the Labour Party at the moment was his lukewarm performance, and at times what was seen by Alan Johnson leading the Labour's campaign as positively hindering the campaign. But you have to come back as well, as with all these issues, to the pattern of media coverage. And those were fascinating figures you gave us. But if anything, you know, 6 out of 9 newspapers essentially backing the Leave campaign. 1 out of those 9 is the Financial Times, whose wider circulation is rather small, so that would anyway make it 6 out of 8. And one of those notionally in favour, because of its editorial line, was The Times, but as you pointed out, it's the stories it was covering were overwhelmingly negative. So the domination is even greater. You said in coverage terms, readership terms, it was over 2-to-1 against. It would be interesting to relate that to the pattern of media ownership. I remember a few years ago hearing that 67% of the British press, written national press, in ownership terms, is owned by just 3 people, 3 groups, all of whom have a Eurosceptic agenda. This is not new, of course. The ground was laid for this. Yeah. Over years and years and years of Euro myths and negative coverage about Europe.
But one could say that, of course, it's great that we have a politically engaged media that take a position. That happens also during general elections, and that in that way it's perhaps part of creating the debate. But I think what these numbers are not telling us is another issue which one could quantify, and I know that you went into quite a lot of detail during the campaign in terms of taking the so-called facts and actually checking whether they held true or not. And so if the media, whichever side it had decided to go, or however it was biased, but if it had still the legitimacy of the factual analysis and the information provider, then one cannot really take issue with printed media taking a position during their campaign. But I believe that you are of the opinion that that was not the case.
Well, I think you were referring as well to the app I produced called Doorstep EU, which you can could be downloaded, still can be, to iPhones. And I had, by the end of the campaign, some 24,000 downloads. It was taking the stories each day, saying, is this true? Is it not true? And trying to give factual evidence. There was always links to evidence. Don't just take my word for it. Sadly, the number of downloads went up even more in July. It's a bit like the Google story. The number of people who Googled, what is the EU, soared in July, which I think is also telling. It goes back to what you were saying about the tone of the coverage, about blue on blue fights, media, you know, personalities rather than facts. It wasn't really a factual analysis. Okay. And even the BBC, you know, constrained by its 50-50 rule, what it did was say, okay, 50% for this side, 50% for that side, but not really questioning the facts on either side. They assumed each side would do that. And it would give 50% to a Labour Remain and 50% to a Labour Leave in some programmes, even though the Labour Party was unanimous at party conference to remain. There's only a few Labour Leave campaigners from prominent Labour politicians, but they were given 50-50. So even that didn't redress the factual balance.
Okay. So before I open up to questions from all of you, I just have a very quick question for each of you to answer, which is regarding the Brexit debate post the referendum, so where we are right now. What are your expectations regarding the debate? Will we continue to have a debate in the first place, and what do you expect in terms of the media role in that?
I just want to quickly pick on one point that's been made before.
Very quick.
Very quickly. The sort of allegation that Vote Leave tried to make this a blue-on-blue attack. Now, we went to great lengths to have a Labour chairperson, Gisela Stewart. So we tried to bring in the Labour Party into our campaign in a big way. So we explicitly weren't blue-on-blue. On the point about the post-referendum debate, I think what's been particularly interesting is actually how, because things have stabilised extremely quickly politically with a new Prime Minister, because the economy hasn't gone to hell in a handcart, because we haven't had to have the Brexit budget, because manufacturing is up, because consumer confidence is up, because things are going very well, what's been interesting is actually how people are actually now quite positive about where we are with this debate. So I think the debates continue, but it's not really finely balanced as it was during the campaign, 52-48. There's now a bit of a groundswell towards the Leave position.
Lucy, what do you make of the debate right now?
Unsurprisingly, I don't agree. I think it's actually a bit of a rerun of the campaign, which is those Brexit-supporting newspapers saying, well, if there is any economic damage, it's because you guys are talking the economy down. None of it's real. I think what I'd say in terms of phasing is that I would predict that as soon as Article 50 is triggered, or as soon as there is some kind of a proposal of actually what does our negotiation look like, let's come back again and talk about what's happening to the economy. I think businesses across the piece have pressed the pause button. Investment is not happening. Decisions are not being taken. And the only reason that huge numbers of banks and others are not yet moving is because they want to see what happens with the negotiations for as long as possible before they start going down that road, because once you've moved your headquarters abroad, you're not going to be able to stop it. So I hope that more fact and more sort of informed coverage will take place over the course of this. I think there is a huge need for proper scrutiny of the negotiation. I think there's a risk that, given the personalities involved, we've already seen David Davis, Liam Fox, Boris Johnson, everybody just briefing whatever the hell they like, potentially getting slapped down then by Number 10 because it's not actually government policy. You know, if that is not sort of brought under control and properly scrutinised, and actually we need a really good opposition at the moment, and that's just not really happening.
But the media also has a role to play on
that. It absolutely does, and in a non-partisan way, which I think there is a huge danger of given that economic story in the Brexit newspapers.
OK, Jonathan.
I certainly don't want there to be a rerun of the campaign and the referendum all over again. Indeed, you know, I think everyone needs to come together and accept the referendum result and get the best deal out of the negotiations to come. And I have been encouraged, whether it's someone like Nick Bowles on the Tory side, who is a Remain campaigner, who's now said, you know, we've got to be optimistic about the future, and he is optimistic about the future, or indeed, you know, someone like Emma Reynolds or Liz Kendall on the Labour side, who said, absolutely, no second referendum, we've got to make the best of this and get a good deal. And I think, you know, I'm very disappointed when I, you know, when there are those figures who are saying, oh, well, let's have another referendum. Well, that's not very productive, that's not very sensible.
What do you think the media's take is? Is it a continuation from what we had during the campaign?
I mean, the media is obviously going to be led to a large degree by what is being fed to them by the politicians and the players in all of this. When you have Nick Clegg coming out saying, you know, we should have a second referendum, then clearly that will get some coverage. You know, I was very pleased to hear Vince Cable saying, you know, what a preposterous notion that would be and how counterproductive it would be. But until... the political class and the obsessive Remainers, whom I'm sure there are a number in this room, accept the result, you know, it will be hard for everyone, including the media, to move on to the next stage.
Okay. Richard?
You know, normally you would expect a referendum to settle things, the people have spoken, but I'm struck by the large number of people who are saying it's not quite settled yet. Partly because of the process itself, the Leave lies, the rigged electorate, who was allowed to vote, who was not allowed to vote, partly because Nigel Farage himself said 48-52 settles nothing. But leave that to one side. I think you know, the government considers it has a mandate to negotiate Brexit. Fine, you can take that as your conclusion of the referendum. But surely it has to be a Brexit that works for Britain, and that bears some resemblance, at least, to the promises that were made by the Leave campaign. And when that starts to appear not to be the case, then I think the debate will liven up again. And there's a key question in all this. I mean, there's good reasons why Article 50 hasn't been triggered. There's a list as long as your arm of subjects that need to be addressed, of issues, and they're still making the inventory, let alone having a position on them all. But the key one is Britain aiming to stay in the single European market, but then you have to follow its rules without a say on them anymore, including free movement? Or are you attempting to leave entirely, and then you have a tariff barrier and an even bigger regulatory obstacle to exports to your main export market, hitting our economy, costing us jobs? The government's divided on this, but when they come off the fence, either way, there will be Leave voters who will be entitled to say, hang on a minute, that's not what I was told. That's not what I voted for. And I think at that moment, the debate will liven up again considerably, but probably with the same media bias that we had before.
Okay. So before I take questions from the floor, I should just mention, because I think I forgot in the very beginning, that of course I see that there's a lot of activity on Twitter already, but there is a hashtag to follow for the event. EU Ref Media is the one if you are tweeting, so please go ahead with that. I'll take three questions to start with. Please state who you are and where you're from and your question briefly, and there's a mic that will come around. So if we start here in the front, they were very quick.
I think my question is primarily...
Who are you, sorry?
I'm John Preston, South Bank University and European Movement, so my partiality is declared a little bit. I think my question is primarily aimed at David Levy. Your report was mainly statistical, but to what extent do your statistics reflect the quality of the campaigning?
I'll take two more questions, if that's okay, David, and then we'll come back to you. So go ahead. Then
you are. Nikolai Goshko, Sputnik News. My question is to Richard Corbett, MEP. To turn the tables round, what is your assessment of European press coverage of the campaign, its result, and, of course, the aftermath? Is it informative? Is it reasoned? Will it help, actually, the politicians in Europe to strike a good deal with Britain for both sides, or is European press coverage is muddled as anything else?
Okay, thank you. And then just behind you.
Thanks. I'm Steve Barnett, University of Westminster. David will be aware of a book that was put together a few weeks after the referendum by Bournemouth University, where a number of academics, myself included, published the results of their own research. There is some preliminary research about agenda setting, and it seems to me that that is one of the most crucial questions, because a lot of people, exactly it was said, who are undecided, will look to the broadcasters. Certainly the preliminary research suggests, I mean, I think it's important to squash this canard that broadcasters are full of liberal metropolitan elites. In fact, the suggestion is fairly clear that broadcasters follow the agenda set by the press. Now, we need some more serious empirical research on this, but certainly the preliminary evidence is, and from talking to anecdotally to some of the producers involved, there is no question that they take their initial questions and their agendas from what they read in the press. So my question is really to David, which is, to what extent did you distinguish between op-ed and news pieces? Because if you look at the role of journalists in this, there are certainly journalists working for some of the tabloid press and the pro-leave press who I think felt pressurized to twist their own news stories towards the Leave campaign.
Okay.
They're perfectly entitled, obviously, in the op-ed pieces, but I just wondered to what extent you'd looked at that.
Okay, thank you very much. So we'll start off with those three questions. David, you had two of them, in fact.
Okay, the first, excuse me, The first one on quality is an easy one to tell you what we did, a harder one to assess. We didn't look at quality. We were looking at, as I said at the beginning, basically, we were looking at a huge number of issues. If we dug into the quality or accuracy of any of these stories, we would have maybe looked at 20 stories rather than 2,300 or so. So we didn't look at quality. The point from Steve Barnett on agenda setting, I think you're probably right about agenda setting and broadcasters, but one would really need to, as you say, one would need to document that and test that, and we didn't do that. So that's beyond the scope of what we looked at, but I think it's a hypothesis worth testing and worth looking at, and one could actually work that out by looking at what stories were covered each night on the television news and how they mapped up, how they lined up against the press coverage that morning. We did code stories. I think I'm right, Diego. We do know the answer to which ones are op-ed and which are straight news pieces. I haven't got the figures in front of me here, and in the interest of time, both in the report actually and here, we accumulated everything together. But we can find out the answer to that, but we haven't analysed it in any. I mean, we haven't sort of worked on it. But if you talk to myself or Diego Baronzo, co-author, who's in the front row here afterwards, we could talk to you about that afterwards. I just throw in one thing. There was some mention of social media earlier on, and there was the book that Steve Barnett referred to from Loughborough and Bournemouth Universities. It also includes an article in there from somebody in the Oxford Internet Institute about what was happening on Twitter. And the author of that found that on Twitter, the Leave camp outnumbered Remain 7-1. During the things that he was looking at.
Okay, thank
Twitter
you.
Twitter isn't owned by three media
barons. Twitter is democratised and it's individual people making their own decisions about what they tweet about.
And a lot of organisations who put a lot of effort and money into it,
but
that's another question.
£9 million.
I'd also say that it's mainly people who've already made up their mind. So actually something like Facebook is where undecided voters are. So so Twitter, I would say, is a complete echo chamber. It's people repeating the own thing, among their supporters.
Right, okay. Okay, Richard, there was one specifically to you, and then
on the
rest.
European media coverage during the referendum campaign, I don't know, I was too busy campaigning. In terms of the aftermath, though, and European media and indeed politicians, I think the initial reaction was, okay, you decided, get the hell out, have done with it, let us get on without you. That's attenuated now to a more mature realization of the magnitude of the mother of all divorce cases. Whatever your point of view, whether you want a successful Brexit or whether you want to take time perhaps to have a rethink at some stage, either way, it makes sense not to rush into this, but to have a complete inventory of all the things that need to be sorted on both sides and have a position on them on both sides, because they're not going to find it easy among the 27 to find a common position on a lot of these issues either. So preparation makes sense, whatever your perspective.
Okay. Yeah?
Can I pick up on the agenda setting point? And my view overall of comms is that newspapers do play a huge role in terms of setting the media agenda. But looking back at the referendum campaign, I would say for both of the campaigns, we were basically usually leading on broadcast. And if I think of some of the factory visits that both sides did and some of the interventions made, like the PM's press conference about 10 days out, I think, and various clips that we got Boris Johnson and Michael Gove to do, it was very much broadcast-led, I'd say. Mm-hmm.
Okay. There were quite a lot of hands up, so I'll go straight to there's a gentleman in the front.
Hi, I'm Chris Sumner from the Online Privacy Foundation. We did some work looking at personality traits, psychological biases, cognitive biases and whatnot in relation to the referendum. And found that folks on both sides were liable to things like confirmation bias and whatnot, but we found that Leavers did slightly worse on that. So my question really is, with the press coverage, you don't need a lot of press coverage to tilt the needle from one side to the other, especially when it comes to like immigration. So if psychological biases can be manipulated in this way, and I thought Project Fear was an excellent way of manipulating people, because UKIP had a head start by some 20 years, how do we regulate the press in their use of numbers, specifically the, like the Daily Mail would use like numbers for immigration, but not, you know, link them to percentages. So when it's talking about how many people it would, we'd be, you know, refugees would be accepting, use raw numbers rather than a percentage of the population. So those sort of things, I think, really matter in terms of how press coverage is used, because I think people can be manipulated in many ways, and I have to believe that they possibly have been, at least enough to tilt the needle.
Okay, so regulation of the press on this. The gentleman just behind you and then at the back.
Hi, I'm Mark English from the European Commission office here. Just a throwaway remark first. I'm a bit puzzled by talk about a second referendum because we've already had two. I think we're talking really about a third referendum. But my question isn't that. My question is more going deeper into the roots of this. It's perhaps more a question for David Levy about the nature of the British press. Like Richard, I do read the European press, and I do compare, and I've also worked as a spokesperson with British press and with European press, and there is one big difference. Everyone knows where newspapers, wherever they are in Europe, stand. Le Figaro will support one side in a French election, Libération another. However, the British press seems to me, and I don't know if you agree, exceptional in the way that it combines news, in inverted commas, extremely biased editorial comment and quite often outright deception in news articles. And my question is, I'm not actually distinguishing between sides in the referendum campaign here. My question is more, can we ever have a sensible discussion, a sensible political discussion in this atmosphere, or do we need a basic culture change before we can have any sort of, if you like, fruitful debate?
Okay. And then, Marianne, at the back.
Good evening. I'm Gaëtan Perdoux, European politics student at King's College London, and I was really interested by the number you showed that really showed the negativity of the political campaign of Remain, the Remain political campaign. And I was wondering if in the future discussions on the evolution of Brexit or just on the future relationship between the UK and Europe, this opens the door for more positive approach to Europe from the British people, for example, through the new journal, that has been created, the New European, or for example, people who are marching for Europe in the streets of London all summer. So I was wondering if you had any idea of a new approach for Europe from the UK after the Brexit vote. Sorry.
Okay, thank you. I think this time I'll start with you, Richard, and go this way.
I didn't think they were particularly addressed to me, these questions. Certainly I'm not going to hazard offer on how best to regulate our press.
Oh, I thought you were going to take exactly that one and tell us if we can have a sensible debate ever.
Yeah, well, no, I agree that the British press is unique in Europe in many, many ways. I can't say I know every country's press, but the ones I do know, there's nothing quite like it in terms of its style, its virulence, the mixing of factual articles and political positions, as was said. What you do about it, though, is, we had a very delicate debate even on the modest proposals about preventing abuse such as phone hacking. It's not easy to do anything about that, and people are very wary, naturally, about governments or legislators trying to do something about the press.
Okay. Jonathan.
So I don't know the answer.
I totally agree with Richard that we need to be very cautious about government regulating press, because we should be very proud of having a free media. And, you know, we have a very varied media, and indeed, as I would, the point I was making earlier about, you know, use of social media and digital media is that, you know, that the blogosphere has massively democratized the media, in that, you know, any one of you can set up an online media platform and challenge whatever consensus you might want to challenge. And, you know, readership of papers is indeed going down as well. So, you know, in that sense, times are changing. And our friend in the second row from the Commission talked about, you know, the media being deceptive in its coverage. Well, you know, politicians can be equally deceptive and dishonest too, can't they?
Okay. Lucy?
I think Mark's point about can we have a sensible political discussion in this climate, I think, is a really good one. And I think the of the main lessons to be learnt from this is just how kind of febrile the atmosphere got and how nasty and the amount of abuse that people like me got on social media and the real level of animosity towards you. I went to lots of events around the country, some of which were, you know, hugely Leave areas, and was frankly heckled and abused throughout the thing to the extent I couldn't be heard, and threatened to walk out if people couldn't be quiet. So, you know, it shows that there is a huge amount of passion about the issue, and I think it's fantastic that, you know, people did get involved in the debate and quite right to try and be informed and so on. But at the point that we have just lost respect for experts, politicians, economists, business people, I think that's really, really dangerous. And I think, you know, just looking at the sort of the levels of abuse for EU migrants, for example, being asked when are they going to go home and things like that, I feel ashamed and upset that that is what has happened as a result of this campaign. And I'm sure it wasn't, you know, what anybody on either side at the campaign level hoped for, but yet that's where we find ourselves. And I think particularly when promises are made, for example, about the 350 million, about the new hospital every week, you know, the fact that we will be able to entirely control free movement and that's not going to hurt our economy at all, these things are simply not possible on the basis of the rules as they currently exist. And so I think, as somebody else mentioned, there are going to be a hell of a lot of very angry Leave voters who felt that they were voting for something which is simply not deliverable. Mm.
Yeah. Matthew, so if I can just take the point that was made. So obviously leaving the EU doesn't mean that EU migrants are going to leave the country overnight, or that in fact any quotas, etc., are going to be come into force anytime soon. So there are a lot of EU migrants in the country. I'm one of them. Sure. But do you think that there is room in the debate for the new voices to that group in the country?
I haven't really thought about that question. Mm. Can I address the question about EU migrants, though?
Okay, I'd like to hear the other one too, though.
I think the Leave campaign, and I'd actually also say UKIP in this situation, should be given a certain amount of credit for the fact that throughout the referendum campaign, we made it very, very clear that we weren't expecting people to, e-migrants to leave in the event of a Leave vote. That we felt that any e-migrants in the UK at the moment should, of course, be allowed to keep their residency here. And indeed, about a fortnight after the election, I signed a letter along with some other people on this point. So we should never be accused of saying that people should be sent home or anything like that. I think it's an important point. In terms of new media in this area, I think that a bit like the European issue spurred the growth of UKIP over the past 15 years, I can also see the European issue spurring the perhaps the resurgence of the Lib Dems in a way, and new media outlets like the New European newspaper as well. So I can see that being a kernel that would change. I can't see it having a big effect, though. I don't think it's going to reverse the result. Mm. I don't think it's going to lead to a second referendum or lead to a staying in the EU, but I think it will be an element of the community. Can I talk about the facts as well, and about the things about the NHS and all these issues as well, which Lucy brought up? I think it is worth saying as well that on the Remain side, you know, you also came out with a whole load of facts as well about how, you know, were we to leave, the economy would be plunged into recession, how there would have to be a Brexit budget, how taxes would have to increase by 15 billion, how government spending would have to be cut by 15 billion, how house prices would have to sort of fall by about 18% this year. You know, none of these facts have also happened.
So I think it's easy to sort of throw mud on one side.
Yeah, I'd say on that specifically is that a lot of those are long-term projections. I agree. I think the emergency budget was a mistake, and in fact that wasn't done by the campaign. It was a decision by people to do something which I think did harm our credibility. I can't remember who said that, but absolutely I agree that it did do that. But I think when you... to have one of your main campaign promises as an outright lie, when it's being said to you by the UK Statistics Authority, by the Treasury Select Committee, this is a highly misleading figure, and to have lots of Leave campaigners disown it almost immediately as soon as the vote is over, and that this money cannot go to the NHS. I think so many people voted on that basis. It was a hugely clever campaign slogan, and to put it on a bus, brilliant, because it got people to vote for you. But given that it cannot happen, I just think that is highly misleading and totally disingenuous, and frankly would not have run a campaign on the basis of that.
I disagree, but let it rest.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It was put
we have a few hands still, and only 10 minutes left. So I'm going to take another round of questions, and let's keep it to the questions. The lady just behind you, Marion.
I'm Mary Dzhevsky. I write for The Independent and The Guardian, so you can see where I'm coming from. Also, I want to look at it a bit from the practitioner's side. One of the things I think that was crucial, that was actually worked rather perversely, which was that the Remain campaign was very, very tightly organised. When you talk about a relatively few number of people being cited, this was because a relatively few number of people were being put out there. The Leave campaign seemed in that respect to be less well organised and therefore a bit more agile on the ground. Second thing, you talked about the emergency budget, but I think there were other statements, especially by Osborne, which completely backfired. Threats of falling house prices, less of a role for the UK abroad, decline of the city. There were plenty of people out there who would say, whoopee, bring it on, that's exactly what we'd like. The third point was that there were
very seductive
stories in their own right. In particular, when Ian Duncan Smith came out and basically said that migration, East Europeans had dominated the labour force and brought wage rates down at the Olympic site. I mean, that would have been a story, whether there was a referendum or not. And I think it was hugely helpful to the Leave campaign.
Okay. I saw, a hand in the front over here.
Hello, I'm Georgina Pattinson from the BBC. A double-edged question, really. One for the Remain campaigners on the panel. What would you change if you could in the press coverage? And for the Leavers, what do you think helped the most?
Okay. And last question was just here, second row.
Hello, my name's Theo Short. I'm here as an obsessive Remainer, and I work for Skype here in London. My question is, if the result of Brexit is that Scotland regains independence and separates from the United Kingdom, if there's the reintroduction of border control between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, and if the government ends up spending, and as yet unknown, but expected to be multi-billions of pounds over a number of years on administering Brexit, will it all have been worthwhile?
Okay. I'll start with you, Matthew.
Lots of different questions for me.
Yeah.
First of all, to pick up on the point that Mary made about the Leave campaign being less organised, I think it's important to understand just briefly sort of why there were essentially two Leave campaigns. One Leave campaign had the vision that you could have one campaign based around UKIP with Nigel Farage as leader. Now, my view is that had that campaign been run like that, it would have got about 35% of the vote. And the vision of Vote Leave was to have a campaign not based on UKIP, a campaign based more broadly right across the parties with senior politicians, senior business leaders supporting it to allow us to get from that 35% to, 52% and win. So it may have come across as disorganised, but there was a logic to why it was happening in that way. Then there's a question about what helped the most. I think what helped the most was the fact that we were able to get a situation where we created this platform which allowed people like Boris Johnson and Michael Gove to join the campaign. So this wasn't like the 1975 referendum, when it was very much the people on the extremes of the left and the right campaigning to leave the common market. We actually had some senior, serious, credible people leading the campaign and actually sort of giving credibility to the Leave message. And also people who people could envisage as being future leaders of the Conservative Party and future prime ministers, and therefore people who could actually enact the sort of things that we were talking about as part of the campaign. So we were sort of serious and based on the centre. In reply to the final question about will it all have been worthwhile, I reject the premise of those questions. I don't think that Scotland is going to go independent. I can't remember what the other points you made were, but I just reject the...
Borders with Ireland.
Borders. I don't think that's going to happen. There's never been a border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. So I just reject the premise of the question.
It's going to.
Yeah. A physical border. I'm talking about. It's not going to happen.
Okay. Let's take the other question. I'd like to hear also. Your question was mainly directed at the Remain side, but also to the Leave side. What would be any changes in hindsight? What would be changes in their campaigns that you would have done differently?
Change the Leave campaign.
Or was everything a success story? Yeah.
We won. It was a tough campaign. You know, it was a campaign fought against all of the odds. It was a campaign based, you know, which led to the, or will lead to the sort of biggest public policy change, you know, ever. It's very difficult in referendums to actually fight against the status quo. And I think what we did in terms of overturning a sort of very heavily dominated status quo, backed by the establishment, backed by a lot of money as well, was pretty extraordinary. So, yes, there are always things you can improve on, but I think overall we did a good job.
Okay. Lucy?
Yes, the fact that we were a tighter campaign, this is news to me, because it didn't necessarily feel like that. And I think partly because we had so many players, it was such a broad church from Caroline Lucas, lots of Labour figures who did a fantastic job, like Alan Johnson and others, and the Conservative Party and, you know, business leaders and all the rest of it. But I think in terms of the media operation, perhaps, you know, the fact that we would put out this is our story of today sort of thing and here are the people that are going to be talking about it, I would say that's perhaps a positive, but maybe for in terms of looking for more colour and more exciting things, perhaps not so good.
I would say that Lucy's press team was the best part of the Remain campaign.
Oh,
and we were in awe. You know, during that period after the David Cameron came back with his deal, and when you were really dominating things and putting out all the stories and the experts and the institutions and the leading people and the economists, it was done massively well.
Oh, well, so. I'm touched. Thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say so. But interestingly, on that score, I think, you know, maybe we peaked too early because particularly coming back to the broadcast and the role of the broadcasters, some said to us, look, guys, you won on the economy. That's done and dusted. So we sort of need to look for other stories. Oh, look, here's this huge immigration issue, you know, 330,000 net figure, suddenly that's something that's a bit more interesting. So, and then it became that we were seen as sort of, well, the economy benefits your side, so therefore if you get an economy story one day, we're going to have to go to the other side the next day and do something that they're putting forward, which actually led to some stories from our side not even being covered, even when they were sort of independent groups. The Royal College of Midwives, for example, is a really interesting example where, you know, first Royal College ever to come out on a political issue like this, which is not specifically linked to what they do, and yet not covered by the BBC because we'd had an economic story the other day, therefore we can't possibly touch it. And I would argue, as a former BBC journalist myself, you make room in your running order. Yes, absolutely, have your leave story and cover it and, you know, put it at the top of the running order and whatever. But to ignore things that are happening, you know, I think it got to a very awkward place. And I think that's partly because people ended up tying themselves up in knots to be sort of balanced and fair. Very quickly, what would I change about... I'm not sure if it's what we did or the way the press covered it. I think what was sort of saddening in a way from the results of this research was that the facts weren't covered as much as they should have been. And I think the fact that we do have now all this research coming out showing that there is sort of buyer's remorse, that people simply didn't feel that they'd been informed about the issues or really understood the full implications. You know, that just means that a decision was taken on the basis of, you know, perhaps personalities, perhaps, you know, what your friends and family were saying, or instinct. And I think when a question of this magnitude and this complexity is put, you know, arguably you need longer than a six-month campaign and you need proper sort of detailed analysis, which I think, given the media climate, simply didn't happen. It was pretty much, this campaign says this, and if it's countered, it's the other campaign. Well, the other campaign says that's a lie, in which case it all sort of balances out. I know that the BBC did a huge amount of fact-checking, you know, and was very sort of rigorous in that, but I think unless something is really analysed within the bulk of that story, I think the understanding and the nuance gets a bit lost.
Okay, thank you, Lucy. Jonathan?
I'll just pick up on the question of what helped the Leave side, in my view. I mean, it's not really a media-related question, but I think the fact that Vote Leave had a very positive, optimistic message to sell to the public and the complete lack of a positive message from the Remain side, I think, was a massive help, and in the a longer term sense, a help for the Leave side was, I think, the fact that, you know, over the last decade or so, the Labour Party, which was nominally supposedly in great numbers in favour of Remain, had basically lost touch with millions of its voters in vast parts of the country who'd voted UKIP in 2009 and in greater numbers in 2014, and those people were basically lost to the Remain side, if you like, and Labour had kind of ignored that as an issue, and the failure to do that left them in the position that we got come the referendum. And there's no indication that a number of figures in the Labour Party appear to have learned that lesson. So that's private grief for you to deal with, frankly.
Richard.
Okay, well, first on that, yes, Labour's campaign wasn't all that it should have been. I said that earlier. Partly also, the Leave campaign was very clever in its organisation. The red bus emblazoned with claims about the NHS was targeted to make traditional Labour voters think Labour was in favour of leaving, getting Gisela Stewart, one of the few Labour MPs who would have anything to do with you, to front your campaign, was also very clever in that respect. Despite all that, it was, what's the figure, 64% of Labour voters voted to Remain. It's a higher percentage than most parties. But it's very patchy, and it's too simplistic to say the North voted to leave, etc. Look at Liverpool. Manchester leads, but Liverpool especially. So how well you organised the campaign locally was...
University
made
cities.
Make a big difference. Mm. On the question of what would I change if I could, I understood it to be what would I change in media coverage if I could. What I'd love but would be more factual analysis. You said 2% of articles quoted academics. Mm. What a shame. That wealth of knowledge, of factual analysis, impartial analysis, doesn't get covered, ignored. That's what I would change there. What I would change in terms of the campaign... The Remain side didn't match the very clever strapline slogan that Leave came up with, which was brilliant. Take control.
take back control.
You can, and they were disciplined in using it in every interview, every article, every speech. All of them. And it, of course, can appeal to everybody. You don't like this? If we could take control, we could do what you want. You don't like that? We could take control. It might be something completely incompatible, but take control. It appealed to everybody. It was brilliant, and we didn't match it. And then the final question on when we see how awful Brexit is, will there be a pressure for a rethink? Well, that remains to be seen, but I think that it's, from what I said before, it's quite likely when we actually see the deal that's made, whichever side they come off the fence on, single market, hard Brexit, soft Brexit, there will be downsides to it. And it was all very well to vote for Brexit as a concept, the nirvana, the answer to all our problems with no difficulties. But when faced with the reality of what Brexit actually entails, I'm not surprised that people are saying there should be a referendum on that. We'll see.
I'm going to stop us here because, unfortunately, we have to finish. But, of course, there are huge repercussions of both the campaign, the coverage by the media. And also, I should say that the referendum has been watched very closely from other European countries with regards to having their own referenda, which is less likely at this stage. But certainly, the deal that Britain gets will have an effect in national politics in a number of other countries. So I do believe that we will hear take back control in a number of other European languages in the year to come. It has already appeared in Germany, but France is to follow, and general elections in Germany and Netherlands will be important too. So it will not stop at the border. The UK's very guarded borders, it will have an effect on the continent for everyone. But I'd like to thank everyone here at the panel. I'd like to thank David for your great presentation and the interesting results. And there is now a reception outside here, so of course the discussions can continue out there. But thank you everyone for coming, and I hope that you can still breathe and feel okay, although it's been very hot in here. Thank you.